Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. How would you write the story of the end of the world? Would you go with hordes of giant metal insects? A genetically engineered pandemic? A zombie invasion from outer space? For a writer with a flair for the dramatic, there is no fun quite like imagining the end of the world, or what comes after. In this hour, a celebration of apocalyptic fiction. From our archives, writers who've looked into the future and found it missing.
There were only so many ways a person could die. Either your heart took you, or your head took you, or it was one of the new diseases. The girl who liked to stand beneath the poplar tree in the park said that she had died into an ocean the color of dried cherries. For a while, the water had carried her weight, she said, and she had lain on her back, turning in meaningless circles, singing the choruses of the pop song she remembered. And all around her, she heard that sound, the one that everybody heard, the regular pulsing of a giant heart.
That's an excerpt from Kevin Brockmeyer's Brief History of the Dead. We'll talk with him in a bit. But first, for an overview of recent apocalyptic fiction, we turn to Justin Taylor, editor of an anthology called simply The Apocalypse Reader, 34 Doomsday Scenarios. Taylor points out that writers have been making up stories about the end of the world for a long time.
Almost from the beginning of time, people were convinced that they were on the cusp of the end of time. And I think that maybe there's something really fundamental in that fact. Something about the sort of absurdity and also, you know, beauty of being here at all. You know, the fact that any of us exist and live is just sort of so phenomenal. And it just immediately occurs to us, you know, in the most general abstract sense, we probably shouldn't be. And maybe soon enough we won't. Those thoughts are sort of conjoined.
Well, and everybody, of course, knows that there is life and there is death. And though it's difficult for any of us to think about our own, we are willing enough, I guess, to think about the end of all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's something comforting about it, right? There's this almost an idea of unity, I think, in this sort of fantasy that you'll be part of the group that witnessed and, you know, not lived through, but, you know, you were there when the world ended as, you know, not you died and everyone else got to go on, but we all went out together. There's a certain camaraderie in that.
There's a story called Gigantic. Introduce it for us, will you?
So Steve Aylett is a British writer. His work really transcends just about any genre. So in this story from Steve's collection called Toxicology, a guy named Professor Skychum, basically he's discovered this secret about the universe, which is that there's this problem with guilt, that it's accreting sort of in the interstices of the time-space continuum. And all human guilt from basically every, you know, bad thing that humans have ever done to each other is creating this physical stuff. And Skychum has basically realized that it's reaching a critical mass.
Over the White House, a screeching noise erupted. The central eye of a multidimensional airship was opening. For the space of two heartbeats, everything stopped. Then a tiny tear dropped out of the eye, splashing on the White House roof. And then another. These were corpses, these two, human corpses, followed by more in a shower which grew heavier by the moment. And then the eye began gushing. 68 forgotten pensioners buried in a mass grave in 1995 were dumped over the Chicago social services. Hundreds of blacks murdered in police cells hit the roof of Scotland Yard. Thousands of slaughtered East Timorese were dumped over the assembly buildings in Jakarta. Berlin was almost instantly clotted, its streets packed wall to wall with victims. Beijing was swamped with tank fodder and girl babies. No longer preserved by denial, they started to sludge. Carpet bombing gore splattered the suburbs, followed by human slurry tumbling down the streets like lava. Cheap human fallout from pain ignored and war extended for profit. The first wave. So far, only 60 years worth.
That's an image that's not likely to leave soon. It's interesting how
Many of the writers seem to look at the apocalypse, I guess, as a way to tell us who we are and where we are and what we're doing. I was thinking back about Nathaniel Hawthorne. I can't remember the name of the story that he wrote that you included.
It's called Earth's Holocaust. It's sort of a fable. This figure, very much like Hawthorne himself, is watching this movement and these people, as he says, "The wide world had become so overburdened with an accumulation of worn-out trumpery that the inhabitants determined to rid themselves of it by a general bonfire." So people are just – they're tired of their stuff and the old ways in the world. And so they build this bonfire and they start throwing things into it, you know, just old junk that they don't need anymore. And then the bonfire gets a little bit bigger and then they decide that they're going to get rid of – coats of arms. We don't need these anymore. You know, this is the old way and all men are better than this and so on. So they start burning coats of arms, tobacco, marriage licenses, money, tax documents. The bonfire keeps getting bigger and they keep getting more aggressive.
"See what heaps of books and pamphlets," cried a fellow who did not seem to be a lover of literature. "That's just the thing," said a modern philosopher. "Now we shall get rid of the weight of dead man's thought, which has hitherto pressed so heavily on the living intellect. Into the fire with them. Now you are enlightening the world indeed."
I think it's fascinating to look back at a century ago or more and see that people are concerned about some of the same things that we are. There are some of the authors who have had some fun. Neil Gaiman, for instance. He has a story, I think it's called When We Went to See the End of the World. It's told by an 11-year-old girl.
Yeah, that story is a riot. Neil posits that the end of the world is a place for him, almost like a cheesy amusement park. So it's narrated by Donnie Morningside, age 11 and a quarter, whose parents are taking the whole family on this trip to go spend the day at the end of the world and have a picnic there.
"This is what it looks like at the end of the world, which is the best place in the world. There is a hole in the ground, which looks like a very wide, big hole, and pretty people holding sticks and scimitars that burn come up out of it. They have long golden hair. They look like princesses, only fierce. Some of them have wings and some of them doesn't. And there's a big hole in the sky, too, and things are coming down from it, like the cat-heady man. And the snake's made out of stuff that looks like glitter gel, like I put it on my hair at Hallowmorn. And I saw something that looked like a big old buzzy fly coming down from the sky. There were very many of them, as many as stars. They don't move. They just hang there, not doing anything. I asked Daddy why they weren't moving, and he said that they were moving, just very slowly, but I don't think so. We set up at a picnic table. What's after the end of the world? I said to my dad. Nothing, he said. Nothing at all. That's why it's called the end. Then Daisy was sick over Daddy's shoes, and we cleaned it up."
It's funny, isn't it, to think of them taking a, yeah, a day trip to see the end of the world. There are so many themes that sort of come back. Different people treat them different ways. There is a story called These Zombies Are Not a Metaphor, which anybody who has read Richard Matheson's book or I suppose seen the movie I Am Legend would understand.
Well, the premise of Jeff's story is that there's this full-scale zombie outbreak, you know, in this sort of classic George Romero sense, and the narrator and his small group of friends are barricaded in their house trying to stage their last stand. But all the narrator's friends are so preoccupied with the zombie as metaphor to the point where they can't recognize the physical, you know, absolutely non-metaphoric zombie that's physically trying to break the door down.
"When the full-scale zombie outbreak finally occurred, I was the only one prepared. I don't mean with supplies and weapons and secure shelter, but more importantly, I had the proper mental fortification. Baxter said to me, 'These zombies are a metaphorical scourge upon the earth. They represent all that is evil in humankind.' Then he went outside, got bitten, and turned into one of them. I held a meeting with the rest of my housemates. 'Let's be very clear,' I said. 'These zombies are not a metaphorical scourge upon the earth. These zombies are an actual scourge upon the earth.' I pointed out the window. We could see the hordes of walking dead in the streets, tearing into the flesh of the living. These zombies do not represent all that is evil in humankind. They do not represent anything except zombies. Yes, yes, Manny and Janine nodded at me, blank affirmative stares, eager for leadership in the uncertainty of the world's end. A half-decayed, blood-smeared face smashed itself up against my metal-barred, bulletproof glass window. I flipped the switch and activated the electric current. Not an allegory, an analogy, or an illusion, I said. This is not the foreshadowing of the downfall of man. This is the downfall itself.
Wow. What is it that is so attractive about the apocalypse to writers?
Well, I think, you know, that in a certain sense that, you know, all writing, all attempts to create a narrative, they're attempts at mastery, really. You know, you're trying to establish yourself as a speaking voice and, you know, assert some sort of control over a situation, you know, real or imagined. Even just, you know, stake out a little space of your own, you know, in the world. And so the apocalypse, you know, it's this giant signal moment and it has such gravity. And you can really project almost anything you want onto it or fantasize anything you like about it. And that just makes it so ripe. But I think as, you know, as a writer, as an artist, you know that's sort of the biggest way you can bomb out because it's just, it's beyond everybody. So of course it's beyond you. But at the same time, that makes you want to go, you know, write for it.
Justin Taylor is the editor of The Apocalypse Reader, a collection of 34 short stories about the end of the world. Our selections were read by Peter Sobel, Ariella Borod, Norman Gilliland, and Doug Gordon. And you can hear the rest of Jeff Goldberg's zombie story on our website at ttbook.org. Over the years, we've talked with a lot of writers who've imagined the end of the world and what comes after. Coming up, interviews with Margaret Atwood and Jim Crace. But first, Kevin Brockmeyer's breakout novel, A Brief History of the Dead.
Chapter 1, The City. When the blind man arrived in the city, he claimed that he had traveled across a desert of living sand. First he had died, he said, and then, snap, the desert. He said that the desert was bare and lonesome, and that it had hissed at him like a snake. Then everything went still and began to beat like a heart. It was only at that moment, he said, with a million arrow points of sand striking his skin, that he truly realized he was dead. The stories people told about the crossing were as varied and elaborate as their 10 billion lives. Lev Paley said that he had watched his atoms break apart like marbles, roll across the universe, then gather themselves together again out of nothing at all. Hanbing Lee said that he woke inside the body of an aphid and lived an entire life in the flesh of a single peach. Graciela Cavazos would say only that she began to snow, four words, and smile bashfully whenever anyone pressed her for details.
Kevin Brockmeyer reading A Brief History of the Dead, his novel about the end of the world. The city is the place where you go when you're dead but not forgotten. Brockmeyer told Anne Strangechamps the notion
came from a piece of African folklore that I ran across in a book of nonfiction by James Lewin called Lies My Teacher Told Me. And he mentions very briefly toward the end of the book this notion in African folklore of three terrains of existence: the living, which is a terrain we all understand, the dead who have not yet passed out of living memory, which are called the Sasha in this realm of folklore, and then the dead who have passed out of living memory, who are the Zamani. And the dead who have passed out of living memory might not be entirely forgotten, but again, there's nobody around who specifically remembers encountering those people. And this was a notion that intrigued me, and the more I thought about it, the more interested I became in this kind of between stage, the Sasha, the dead but not yet forgotten. Occasionally, one of the dead, someone who had just completed the crossing, would mistake the city for heaven. It was a misunderstanding that never persisted for long. What kind of heaven had the blasting sound of garbage trucks in the morning, and chewing gum on the pavement, and the smell of fish rotting by the river? What kind of hell, for that matter, had bakeries and dogwood trees and perfect blue days that made the hairs on the back of your neck rise on end.
Now, when this book opens, the City of the Dead has a problem. More and more people are dying, so the city is filling up.
Yes.
But just as rapidly, it seems to be emptying out.
Yes.
What's happening?
Well, you know, again, the notion behind the book is that you remain in the city only so long as you last in living memory. So as people continue to die, they appear in the city. But as the people who remember them also die, they vanish from the city. And by the end of the first chapter, it becomes plain that a calamity of some kind has befallen the world of the living. And so more and more people have appeared and then vanished very, very swiftly from the city.
And in fact, what's happened is this enormous pandemic, a plague,
yes,
has swept the world, the kind of virus maybe we're all terrified of, you know,
yes,
when you read headlines in the papers. What are some of your, this is an odd question, but what are some of your favorite parts about the human race dying off?
Well, I guess the things that would come to my mind are just tiny moments that appear here and there in the text. One of them is there's a woman to whom we're introduced in the second chapter, Laura Bird, who's been isolated in the Antarctic and doesn't quite know what's happened. And she slowly begins to discover that this virus has befallen the human race. And at one point, she picks up a radio signal from a man who's broadcasting in another language. And he's just repeating a message on a loop, just speaking to anybody who could possibly hear him about what's happened, and also saying goodbye to his wife in case she's out there listening somewhere. I remember that. And then I remember
that passage. And the thing he keeps repeating is something like, do not come to the city. There are no survivors.
Yeah.
Repeat, there are no survivors.
Yeah.
And just
yeah,
the sound of this one lone voice, that's yeah, all that's left. It's a really grim, terrifying moment.
Yes, yes. And then another thing, a small detail that for some reason is lodged in my head, is this notion of a planet depleted of all human life that is continuing to be circled by the satellites that we shot up into the atmosphere.
You know, your book falls into the sort of rubric of a kind of literature people call post-apocalyptic fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I really like so much about yours is it's not a horribly morbid book. In fact, there's such, I think part of it is because you treat most of your characters with great tenderness and great affection. But I wonder, was that a deliberate choice? I mean, did you think about how your book might fit into this field of post-apocalyptic fiction?
Well, I suppose most of the fiction of this type that I've read myself, even if I love it, it is fiction that has kind of a grim attitude toward the human race and doesn't think very highly of us and what
we're
capable of.
So we might as well be wiped out.
Yeah, yeah, that seems to be the attitude. And again, there are a lot of these books that I admire, but it's just not my attitude. You know, I mean, I wanted to tell a story, a post-apocalyptic story that was loving toward its characters.
One of the other things that I really like about this book is the fact that in many cases, people's lives have improved by dying.
Yeah.
So Laura's parents, who have died in this plague, wind up falling in love all over again,
yes,
after they're dead. There's a wonderful kind of heart-filled passage in which you describe that. I wondered if you'd read that for us.
Sure. Dying had changed Marion Bird. She had been so weary back when she was alive. Weary of talking and weary of eating. Weary of thinking, remembering, desiring, anticipating. Weary, most of all, of the prospect of seeing her life out to its natural end. But then the virus had appeared and she had died. And suddenly everything was different. She began to appreciate all the things she thought she had forgotten how to enjoy, like music and dancing, and the way the breeze felt on her neck when she pinned her hair up and back. And then there was the matter of her husband. It seemed only natural, with all the other changes she had undergone, that she would love him again. She listened to him swishing his razor around in the sink, for instance, and then tapping it clean against the porcelain, tap, tap, tap. And she knew that he would clear his throat next, and then dry his face. And only after he had blown his nose into a tissue and carefully straightened the towel on the rack would he call out to her with some question or other. The whole unwavering performance used to fill her with despair, but these days she found herself charmed by it.
Why do you think we like imagining the end of the world or thinking about it? Because this certainly isn't a subject that only fiction writers take on. I mean, people think a great deal about the end of the world in lots of different ways.
Yes, they do. I mean, almost every religious tradition has got its own tale of what the end will be like. You know, it may come back to that mystery I mentioned, just our lack of knowledge about what we're doing here and, you know, how strange it is simply to be here at all. You know, what will become of us when the whole thing comes to an end?
Beyond the awareness of the mystery and the curiosity, though, I think there's some actual pleasure we take in imagining the end and really sort of sketching it out the way you've done. I wonder where the pleasure comes in.
Well, I mean, it certainly cleans things up a lot, you know, to know where things are going, doesn't it? And aside from that, I mean, we're storytelling creatures. Most of us are, at least, and we take great pleasure in stories. And if you've got a story, you want to know the beginning and the middle and the end. And, you know, we're all immersed in the middle, so we know a lot about that. And we have a lot of speculation about the beginning and a lot of speculation about the end, but we have no direct experience of it. And so I think telling stories about the beginning and the end might simply satisfy that storytelling impulse in us.
Kevin Brockmeyer, talking with Anne Strangechamps about his novel, A Brief History of the Dead. He's since come out with a new novel, The Illumination. We're celebrating apocalyptic fiction from the TT Book Archives in this hour. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Nature and religion come together in writer Brenda Peterson's new memoir, I Want to Be Left Behind. Peterson grew up in a natural paradise, in a forest ranger cabin in a remote wilderness, with a family that prayed eagerly for the end times to come so they could leave this earth. She told Steve Paulson that as a child she felt torn apart.
These two strains were the paradox of my childhood because my father, who is part Native and taught me everything about the natural world and other animals, also ascribed to this belief system, and I couldn't put them together. It didn't fit because there was a belief system that was disembodied, and I had grown up for 5 years on this forest lookout station with more animals and acres of wilderness than people. So my perspective was really much more Native and much more this idea of the earth is bountiful, the earth is abundant, the earth is sacred. And I think that what happens is when you have a belief system that doesn't jive with your experience, i.e. the forest, then you spend a lot of time trying to figure out how there's a common ground.
So how did this play out with your family then as you grew up and grew away from their religion? Was this hard in terms of how you and your parents got along?
It was difficult for the larger extended family. My parents and I have come to a hard-won equipoise because we did grow up in that cabin on the forest together. And there's a chapter in the book that goes to Baja with my father and mother. By the way, she worked for the CIA for 17 years, so you can see that she also had that belief system. And in the plane bound to the Baja birthing lagoons of the gray whales, my parents and I make a vow, no politics, no religion. And we actually come back to that beautiful trinity that we had in the forest cabin.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that trip you took with your elderly parents to Baja California, going to see the gray whales in their birthing lagoons. You tell a remarkable story about what it was like floating out in your little boat with these huge whales all around you.
These are what Jean-Paul Christophe calls floating planets, these gray whales, and they are survivors of many whale hunts. They come, in fact, they're there right now, and they give birth and they mate in these beautiful, buoyant saltwater lagoons in remote parts of Baja Peninsula. Now, these whales come to the boats. It's not that we chase them down. It's a biosphere. There are rules. And you can go parallel, and the mother calf pairs can choose to encounter humans. And the miracle is that they do. They come to the boats for physical interaction. A wild species who was twice hunted to the brink of extinction comes to our boats and reaches out to be touched. And as Lupita, our naturalist in Baja, said, we can only think of it as forgiveness.
Now, a lot of people, a lot of Americans love nature, at least say they love nature. It's almost become un-American not to love nature. But you seem to take this passion further than most of us. Is it fair to say there's a spiritual dimension to your connection to the natural world?
I definitely feel that my relationship to the earth is a sacred and daily practice of spirituality. I'm hoping to balance our spirituality so that instead of saying, like the Southern Baptist hymn, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through, or that it's Maya, or that it's just something to be endured while we go to the next level, I'm hoping that we will look at this earth as our home and our soul's habitat.
Now, there do seem to be some similarities between the apocalyptic doomsday visions of religious fundamentalists and those of hardcore environmentalists, the people who talk about how global warming and rampant consumerism are going to destroy the planet. I guess it does raise the question, how far would you push that analogy?
It was an analogy that I resisted about 10 years ago when I first came up with it as an environmental editor and writer. And I would go to these environmental groups and I would see the same kind of ferocity and fundamentalism and actual verbal violence that I had witnessed in the Southern Baptist tradition in my past. And I didn't want to see that. I didn't want to even go there. But I had to. I just sat down and made a list of what we shared in common between environmental fundamentalists and rapture end-timers. And I found to my horror that there were many similarities, and I list them.
What are some of those similarities?
Well, humorlessness is the first one I would really go for. Have you ever seen a stand-up fundamentalist comic, either environmentalist or religious fundamentalist? It just doesn't happen. Here's my list. Fundamentalist, environmentalist, two columns. Enraptured by doom, enraptured by doom. Apocalypse now. Righteous anger, thou shalt not, holier than thou. Blame, shame, judgment, evangelical. And when I made that list, it was very hard for me to look at it. And then I had to ask myself, am I a fundamentalist as an environmentalist? So then I had to step back and say, oh no, can I find a middle path? And how can I navigate between extremes?
At one point in your book, you write, what if environmentalists stopped portraying nature as crucified? What if both camps simply stopped all their fear-mongering and found a new story?
Yes. Yes. I talk about this. Original sin among fundamentalists is easily translated into pollution among environmentalists. And in the biblical story, we eat of the forbidden tree and are fallen. And in the green story, we cut down the sacred tree and are self-doomed. So we have biblical Armageddon that parallels mass extinction.
So what would a new environmental story look like? I mean, at least the one that you would like to see.
It would be full of imagination and not fear. It would be full of a kind of humor and not taking ourselves so seriously. These tragic visions constrict the imagination and make us fixated on apocalypse instead of on the enduring earth and the enduring species. And it's an escape from having to do the more mature and difficult gray area work of really figuring out how we and all other species can survive. So I think the word apocalypse really means revelation. So we need less apocalypse and more revelation.
What is your idea of the sacred? I don't know if you'd have a definition or just sort of an idea of it, but I'd love to know what that word means to you.
All that is alive is sacred. All that is alive around me, in me, every person, every stone, every river, everything that is alive is sacred. I live on the water down here in Seattle in the Salish Sea, and every morning I wake up and I see eagles, gray whales, otters. There are great blue herons fishing right off my backyard beach. How could I not believe that everything that is alive and sentient, everything that is alive, everything that is created is sacred?
Brenda Peterson, talking with Steve Paulson about her memoir, I Want to Be Left Behind. She's also just come out with a young adult novel called The Drowning World. Imagine a post-environmental apocalypse. Most of humanity's been lost, and the Earth is decimated. What's life like for those who survived? What kind of new society would they build? What would they believe in? Novelist Margaret Atwood has written many versions of the future in novels like The Handmaid's Tale, Oryx and Crake, experimental zombie fiction, and most recently, The Year of the Flood. When the book came out, she talked with Steve Paulson about its characters, members of a religious cult who call themselves God's Gardeners.
Toby, year 25, the year of the flood. In the early morning, Toby climbs up to the rooftop to watch the sunrise. She uses a mop handle for balance. The elevator stopped working some time ago, and the back stairs are slick with damp. If she slips and topples, there won't be anyone to pick her up. As the first heat hits, mist rises from among the swath of trees between her and the derelict city. The air smells faintly of burning, a smell of caramel and tar and rancid barbecues, and the ashy but greasy smell of a garbage dump fire after it's been raining. The abandoned towers in the distance are like the coral of an ancient reef, bleached and colorless, devoid of life. There still is life, however. Birds chirp, sparrows they must be. Their small voices are clear and sharp, nails on glass. There's no longer any sound of traffic to drown them out. Do they notice that quietness, the absence of motors? If so, are they happier? Toby has no idea. Unlike some of the other gardeners, the more wild-eyed or possibly overdosed ones, she has never been under the illusion that she can converse with birds.
Is this a warning to us? Is this just sort of presenting a possible future? I guess I'm wondering sort of where this impulse comes from for you.
I think it comes from the same place that all human creativity comes from. We like to play with our toys. And we do have a lot of toys right now, and we like to play with them both in reality and in imagination. So you might say it's like that, but you could also say it's really a very hopeful book because it's still only a book. So you can close those covers and you can say to yourself, let's keep that book inside those covers rather than letting it out. You might say that, or you might say, well, no one can really predict the future, which is true. There's too many variables, which is also true. One of the big things that we can't predict right now is one of the major determinants of the future, which is the human race. So how we behave now is, in fact, determining the future. But we don't know how we're going to behave, so we can't really predict the future.
Now, there's a lot of biblical imagery in your novel. There's, of course, the flood that's part of the title of your book, the waterless flood, as your characters call it. There are also Adams and Eves, and your sort of central group of characters go by the name the Gardeners.
The God's Gardeners.
Yes.
They are trying to combine science, religion, and nature with somewhat mixed results. And they do have some rather unusual but not completely out of the question interpretations of Scripture that they rely upon. And they also have, of course, every religion has got music, so they've got their own hymns, and they have their own
special saints, people they honor, such as Saint Al Gore. He will be a saint in the future, you'll be happy to know. And
as well as Rachel Carson and Rachel Carson Mahatma is
definitely
Gandhi.
They're all very saintly. Uh-huh. And Diane Fossey is a saint, and some people you might not expect, such as Robert Burns. He gets to be a saint because of his empathy with mice. And this group lives on rooftops in slums where they grow vegetables and where everything recycled. They're vegetarian unless they get really, really, really hungry, at which point you're supposed to start at the bottom of the food chain.
How did you come up with this idea of God's gardeners?
I think that we're going there. That is, I think that the environmental movement has a lot of characteristics of a religion right now. So I think that's already happening. There is already a Green Bible. I found this out after I finished the book, but there is one. You can get one if you want. It has an introduction by Archbishop Tutu. It's got the green parts in green. It's got helpful green things at the end that you can do to be a greener and more virtuous person. So it's moving that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, the gardeners in your book also have a hymn book. And, in fact, every few chapters you give us one of their hymns. What was your idea behind this, actually creating all these hymns that form, to some degree, the backbone of the book?
I think they would have hymns. As I was looking through the standard hymn book on two recent occasions, namely the funeral of my father and the funeral of my mother, for hymns that would be suitable, by which I mean they would have approved of them, and the rest of the family would also be able to deal with them. There wasn't much on these themes. There isn't actually much in the hymn book that has to do with the rest of the world, with the natural world. There's a few of them, but not really a lot. So my hymns are in standard hymn forms. They're just on subjects that are maybe a little off the beaten track for the hymns of today.
My body is my earthly ark. It's proof against the flood. It holds all creatures in its heart and knows that they are good.
Well, you also have a note at the very end of your book saying that these gardeners' hymns could be used for amateur, devotional, or environmental purposes.
Anybody who wants to use them is welcome to do it. The sheet music is up there on the web, too, so you can pull off, for instance, the Pollination Day song. Sing it at your harvest festival. It's very nice.
It sounds like you had a lot of fun basically creating a new religion.
Well, I didn't try to make it a perfect religion, because none of them are. But I did try to make it a plausible religion. That is, you know, Groucho Marx's old line, I wouldn't want to belong to a club that would have me for a member. So I'm not sure that I would totally want to belong with these people, because they're pretty severe in some areas. The clothing is not very attractive, because they make it all out of recycles and they dye it in dark colors so they won't have to wash it so much. But their general orientation, I think, is pretty worthy.
Margaret Atwood's novel is The Year of the Flood. Steve Paulson spoke with her. You're listening to one of the hymns from the novel called The Earth Forgives.
The earth forgives the miner's blast that rends her crust and burns her skin. The centuries bring trees again and water and fish therein.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
We're sharing apocalyptic fiction from the TT Book Archives in this hour. What's your favorite book about the end of the world? My own list? Well, I would have to include The Pest House by the British novelist Jim Crace. It's a setting we're all familiar with by now. America after the collapse of everything. Government, society, economy, gone. Freeways in ruins, and the few remaining people back to the land to try to eke out a meager living. If you've read Cormac McCarthy's The Road or watched NBC's Revolution, you know the scene. Crace says that's because, like everyone else, novelists watch the news.
We are besieged by different versions of how the world could end or change drastically and how that could happen soon. You know, we're told about things like nuclear meltdown. We're quite used to that over the last 70 years. But there are new things that we've added to that. Global warming. Finally, America and Europe, but America particularly, has recognized that global warming is galloping us towards problems. And there are other things such as contagions and pandemics. Now, I know that in the medieval times, people took those in their stride. They expected there to be black deaths and choleras. Modern medicine has rescued us from those things largely. But look at the way in which AIDS now affects 40% of the people in Botswana and Lesotho. And I heard a scientist saying that if avian flu is able to cross species and the number of deaths is equal to the number of deaths, you know, the same proportion as the number of the deaths that happened in 1919, the last time avian flu affected the United Kingdom, then 19 million people in the United Kingdom could die.
Let's talk about your story, then, this story, yeah. This future that you've created. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that this is America at some unspecified future date, clearly far enough in advance that the disaster occurred well before the beginning of the story. No one really remembers it, although close enough to that, I gather, that the artifacts can still be found regularly of the time before the disaster, whatever it was.
Well, how long does it take anything to rot away? How long does it take a hulk of a ship to be reduced to something which looks almost natural? Probably 80 or 90 years. I mean, we know that polystyrene cups are going to still be there untouched in 1,000 years. But yes, you're quite right. I would say probably 100 years after now is what we're talking about.
And the people who have survived this now live with very little memory of that time. There seems to be almost no history for them.
Well, if you imagine a huge depopulation of America for one reason or another, we don't know what it's going to be, whether it's a pandemic or whatever it is. If you imagine a huge depopulation and a sudden one, even if that depopulation is worldwide, the effects on developed nations such as America and Britain is going to be greater than the effects on somewhere like the Sudan or a remote island in Indonesia. The reason is that our advanced civilizations are so separated from the natural world that we wouldn't know how to find and forage. We wouldn't know how to make rafts. Our ingenuity has failed to keep us informed about how to make fire or shelters, you know, with the help of a building company or safety matches. And so it would not be surprising if there was a collapse of population in the United States of America, given the size of the United States of America, if the infrastructure just collapsed. So that's the starting point. But what this book is not trying to do is to say this is a likely outcome for America. That's not the point about this book. This is not a book about America 200 years down the line or 100 years down the line saying this is a likely scenario. All this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for what I'm concerned about the American condition now. It's about our Western unconcern for the planet. It's about the dangers of being on the top of the pile and coping with being at the bottom of the pile. It's about the American dream and whether the American dream has become blemished in the same way as the American landscape has become blemished.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dream. I mean, I think we all know what the American dream is supposed to be now. You better yourself. In some ways, the dream of your characters is the same, and perhaps what you're saying is that their dream is not much different from ours. It's to attain something that they don't understand at all.
The American dream, it seems to me, is based on something very simple, and it's what accounts for the fact that even though when they carried out an opinion poll in the Middle East just after the beginning of the Iraq War, they asked the question, which country in the world do you most despise? And 84%, I think, said America, predictably, you know, in the circumstances. But later down the opinion poll, they said, which country in the world would you most like to emigrate to? And 83%, you know, only lost 1% of those, said the United States of America. Now, this, in an odd way, you know, tells us about the whole ambiguity of the world's relationship with America. Why is it that America, even though the people who despise America politically, their foreign policy anyway, why is it that they still want to come here? It's because the American narrative is one of delivering on hopes, on coming up with the acre of land when you've never owned land, on giving the job when the Dust Bowls have robbed you of them, of giving you the Hollywood dream if you meet the West Coast. It's a dreaming narrative. American is based on a dreaming narrative, it seems to me. And that dreaming narrative is one which I, as an Englishman, have always bought into. Because the English narrative is entirely different. The English narrative is squeamish and stuttering and blushing. And it doesn't take any risks and it doesn't head out for the frontier. And even if it did head out for the frontier, there'd be no wilderness to encounter. So there's something very basic about the appeal of that press westward, the family with the kids on the mother's breast and the bucket and the cow tied to the back of the wagon, which in a way is beyond destruction. However, it feels that we've lost an image of that. We've lost that because when people now think about America, they don't think of those things. They think of something which is blemished. So my book is about investigating the blemish and revisiting the dream.
We should talk about where your book begins. It is in this future America, and the characters about whom we will care the most are Franklin and Margaret, going not west, as you suggest, but east, in the hope that they will reach the sea and be taken to some promised land. Maybe we ought to know a little bit more about Franklin and Margaret. And if you would, I wonder if you would read a little bit to describe Franklin for me.
In what remained of the slanting light, Franklin Lopez tried to sleep while facing east, downhill. The closeness of Ferrytown was a comfort to him. From his high vantage point, he had seen the busy little lanes and yards and watched the ferry, its raft boards packed with the day's last emigrants and their suddenly weightless possessions, as it was let out on its fat ropes to drift downstream, never quite capsizing, until the four helmsmen dug in their great oars and poles to bring the craft ashore in the shallows of the deeply gravelled landing beach. He had then watched the ferry, unladen, but now set against the river, being towed back upstream by a team of oxen on a winch, and beached for the night at the mooring. He had seen the first lamps lit and heard what sounded like a song. Surely Franklin could not wish for a prospect more reassuring or more promising than this. Once the moon came up, above the leaden volumes of clouds, augmenting what was left of day, the lake in the valley, hidden up till then in mist, was like a silver pendant, with the river as its glinting chain. Franklin had not seen so much standing water before. Perhaps the sea would be like that, flat and safe and breathtaking.
It's disturbing, don't you think, that Franklin takes so much comfort in being close to Ferrytown, this place that we know by this time is going to be a place of death? Or is that just another part of this exploration you're making of the way in which our dreams aren't necessarily what we think they are?
Well, we take human comfort in things, but nature doesn't always play along. You know, it's a natural disaster that kills off the people in Ferrytown. In my books, there's always a tension that exists between the natural world and the so-called civilized world. And my books are always trying to mediate them. The natural world can be sour. The natural world can be full of putrefaction. The natural world can be unnecessarily shocking and cruel. So if we're going to get any mediation between those two things, we might as well admit the truth about it. In the same way that we, humankind, can be lacking in understanding of the natural world and inflict damage on the natural world in the careless way that we have, then the natural world can do the same back to us.
And this pest house, it's more attractive than it ought to be. In some ways, it turns out the pest house is the rock on which the rest of the story is built.
The pest house is America. The pest house is where you go to recover. There are such things. This book started, actually, with me discovering a real pest house on the Isles of Scilly, 35 miles off the coast of Cornwall, where I spend a lot of time, 140 islands there, of which only five are inhabited, and there's one uninhabited one, which in the 18th century was used as a quarantine station for people travelling to the United Kingdom. If you had so much as acne or rosacea or something, people would suspect it would be cholera, and they'd stick you in this pest house until you recovered. Of course, you wouldn't recover because there's already someone there that had got cholera, so you'd catch it and you'd die. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, what a fantastic title for a book. But I also realized that there was an important subject matter there, and the subject matter was emigration and our need to leave home to realize our hopes by going abroad to find those hopes. But hopes dashed, because here would be people traveling on a boat, and simply because they had a red cheek, even though they were within 35 miles and in sight of the cliffs of Cornwall, they would be stuck into the pest house and they would die. So that was the starting point of the book. At that point, when I encountered that story and that actual building, the subject matter of America was not one that I thought would fit into it. It was only when I became conflicted in my own attitudes towards America, you know, after 9/11 and after the Iraq War and after many, many visits here, that I realized that they were all of a piece.
And the pest house must hold some hope for you as well. In this story, it certainly does. Margaret survives the pest house, builds a future on having been yes. in the pest house.
The hope is this, that optimism and hope are found in dark places. An optimism which is found, you know, in a well-lit Hollywood studio is not an optimism worth having. An optimism which is found in a religion which tells you that when you die, you know, you're merely going to spend eternity with heaven. It's such an infantile optimism that it's worthless. I'm an immensely optimistic person. And the optimism that I find in my books, although most people don't recognize it as optimism, is optimism which is as hard as granite because it's come from a tough place. So what I'm saying, I think, in this book is that we all have to go through the pest house, or what that represents, the metaphor of the pest house. America as a nation has to go through the pest house. Britain has and will continue to have to go through pest houses in order to experience the furnace that life provides and in order to come out stronger.
Jim Crace is an award-winning writer, author of Being Dead, Quarantine, and The Pest House. And he has a new novel due out this spring, Harvest. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Apocalypse Now. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strainchamps, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.